is our common welfare. And that's our tradition of our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And I tell you, I didn't learn that my first week here or anything like that. What I did learn here was that I wanted to please my sponsor. I was a people pleaser at heart, you know, and I remember, you know, as most of you know, my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California, and it's a Monday night meeting, and I had never been a part of a home group before. I got sober in a little Alano club, and it served me well, and Jesus, I came into a Monday night meeting, and it just seemed like there was hundreds of people milling around. And I was looking for my new sponsor. I was about 2 years sober, and he was up at the front by the podium and stuff, and off to the side, and he had a crowd of about 10, 11 guys, it seemed like. And to me, it looked like about 50 people, you know, but it was about 10 or 11. And they were all huddled together, you know, and they all had their back towards me, you know what I mean? And I'm, you know, got my new pants from Goodwill on and my little plastic belt, you know, and I'm trying to fit in, you know, and it was just, I just couldn't see, but he was surely pleased to be with them and wanted nothing to do with me. It was quite obvious, you know. And as weeks went by, Johnny would take off for the weekend to go talk or something. And I would call some of these guys in the inner circle, you know, and I'd say, hey, Bob, how come Johnny loves you better? And he goes, oh, my God, Larry, he doesn't love us better. He's just known us longer, for God's sakes. You know, just why don't you get busy and get a commitment here and you hang up, you know. And then, you know, a couple of weeks would go by and the old circle was getting bigger, you know what I mean, And I, Jesus, you know, it's obvious the man don't like me, you know. And he'd take off again, and I'd call up Ray. And I said, Ray, this is Larry. How come Johnny likes you and loves you better? And he goes, oh, for God's sakes, Thomas, why don't you just get a new guy? And he'd hang up on me, you know. And this went on year after year. And now, some 36 years later, Johnny takes off for the weekend, and I get these phone calls. and it sounds something like, Larry, how come Johnny loves you better, you know? And I tell him, because you're a loser, and I'll just hang up, you know what I mean? I learned quick, man, you know what I mean? But I knew I wanted to be a part of that group, you know? The book talks about learning how to rightly relate yourself to people. Boy, I tell you, if there was anything out of sorts, was for me, it was that. I did not know how to rightly relate myself to people. I was so consumed in self and trying to become somebody. You see, that's exactly what alcohol did for me. I started drinking at the age of 11. And, you know, there was just four of us in a garage, and you know, we were passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey, you know, and I remember, you know, never laughing so hard my entire life, never throwing up so much my entire life. And I remember that evening at 11 years old, I kissed my first Latin woman, and it was my aunt. She was a 46-year-old lady that I went after, you know. I marked it, you know. And what happened to me is, can I get a shot of water? What happened to me is the next morning I realized that this little nobody, I always knew I was a nobody, You hear it enough, you begin to believe it. And I tell you what happened to this little nobody. For about 3 or 4 hours, I became somebody. And man, I was sold on the idea that I would rather be a part-time somebody than an all-time nobody any day. And I become preoccupied with doing it again. Now, I didn't head off to Skid Row and come to AA the next day or anything like that. But I got the address. And I began to be preoccupied with doing it again and going to that spot and stuff like that. And because it made me feel like somebody. And that was going to be dangerous to me when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Still looking for that spot when you're sober, you know. Well, I asked for it, huh? That's right. Thank you, Gunga Din. That's right. And I'm a little hungry. No, please. And what happened to me is I found a little spot and I loved it, you know, and I didn't know it would turn on me. You know, I knew my life was taking a right turn when at the age of 16 years old, my best friend was shot and stuffed in a trash can. And I knew I was making a shift. And I never bothered looking back, you know. And what happened to me is about 1974, I was arrested and in a park. I'd been on an abuse for about 90 days for the first time in my life. And so they took me to the Harvard General Hospital. And it seemed that I was wandering around this park over there in El Segundo on a job interview. And I was in a Little League dugout. And I was crying like a baby, and then I would laugh like a clown. And this would go on and on for a couple hours. And then this paranoia that used to come and go through me when I would be DTing and stuff like that kind of stuck. And these hallucinations that used to float stuck. And they said I'd become somewhat catatonic. And I didn't know what that meant. But they took me to the Harvard General Hospital. And in 1974, I was on a gurney with an arm and a leg tied down. And a little doctor came over there and said, "Son, it seems to be by the way you've been living that maybe you need to go to a state facility and be observed for about 30 or 60 days. And so they sent me to this little place, and a year later they let me out. Totally observed, right, you know. We couldn't find a thing in that young man, you know, and they gave me certain medications to take. And what had happened is at the time of my life, everybody was talking about that I needed some goals. And I heard that in schools, and I heard that in stuff like that. And people were telling me that here's what my goals were at this time in my life. Is I was living in downtown Torrance in a boarding house. It was a hallway with 5 rooms with beds, a table, and little windows to look out. And I remember that my goal is I would look out this window, and across the street I would see the Greyhound Hotel. And it would say, "Beds with hot plates." And I said, one of these days I'm going to get it all together and I'm going to live over there and I'll have it made, you know. And well, what happened to me is after a couple months I came out of that little facility, I ran out of Thorazine. And in 1975, they found me over at Alvaro Street in downtown Los Angeles, across the street at a Chevron gas station on a pile of tires, and I wasn't over there vaping. I was over there because it would seem like to be the only place that I could get out of the jungle. And at this time in my life, there is no invisible line of what a guy does and doesn't do to get a drink. And at this time in my life, I'm at what that chapter, More About Alcoholism, so beautifully describes, that alcoholic torture. When he's not drinking, knowing perfectly well what the consequences are. Knowing perfectly well what's happening to my body and what's going on with me. Knowing perfectly well of the things that I've done and the things that I've done to me. Knowing perfectly well what's going to happen to me if I take a drink. That the only thing that not drinking ever squeezes out of this head when I'm sober is this idea that this time it's going to be different. Or in my case, the three most deadliest words that I've ever grabbed onto and can kill me today, what's the use? What's the use? I got give up just barking at me all the time sometimes, you know? And they arrested me for violation of probation, public nuisance, out-of-state forgeries, and they sentenced me to 3.5 years in a state penitentiary. And while I'm up there at Wayside in 1975, after about 30 or 40 days, they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus and send me to the South Bay Courthouse in Torrance, California. I'm in a holding tank about the size of this little middle section here. And one by one, the judge is calling these guys out, and they're not coming back. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where are they taking me now? And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I heard the most beautiful sound I'd heard in a long time. It's some keys coming down the hall. And those jailer keys weigh a ton. And they slide open this jail door, and there's a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he had a grin like a Cheshire cat, and he was shiny and clean like Evie was when he visited Bill, I read. And he's looking in that thing. He goes, "Aye, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And he said, "Yes, sir, I am." She goes, "Ah, that's great." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, oh my God, AA, what's that? You know, I've heard of OR and PO, but you know, what's AA and who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden? You know, I've been hallucinating so much, I didn't know if he was real, you know what I mean? And I tell you, looking back well over 40 years now, I know exactly what he is. Because my home group and this little group today is sprinkled with him. And it's what my book calls a trusted servant. And what made that man a trusted servant was simply this, in my eyes, is he had no business being there. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker. And he just got the worst news of his life. And that news was that his little wife was dying immediately of a terminal illness. And he knew that she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in his meetings in Bellflower or Brentwood or Downey or Norwalk or Long Beach, that man would sit with you in that book and grasp and develop a manner of living that ingrained in him this. Practical experience tells us, nothing will ensure immunity from drinking but intensive work with other alcoholics. This works. He didn't think of milk and whiskey. It had been removed. Just like it happened to Bill in 1935, laying in a bed, the town's hospital. Bill didn't just lay there and something happened. Bill had a visitor. He had a shiny vase, Cheshire grin visitor. And he had these proposals. And he came to Bill's bedside And to the best of their ability, he applied them to his life. And Bill had this profound experience, one that I thought that I was supposed to have, and was secretly frustrated for 5 years because I didn't have that big kaboomy. I thought I'd done maybe my inventory wrong or my ends. Something I did was wrong. And then sitting in that book study, two paragraphs after that man had that experience, in that same little musty bed. Bill's laying in that bed the afternoon, and a thought comes to him. Maybe I could work with other alcoholics. Now, how many of you had that on day one? That's how rare it was. And it dawned on me that maybe, just maybe, that the thing that happened to Bill suddenly, he's hoping and praying, will happen to me gradually. But the end game is the same. The end game is the same. I'm going to be given a gift for me to pass on, that it ain't mine to keep. That he's hoping and praying that I'll pass it on to other. Even back then, he didn't say that I can pass it on to everyone. He says, maybe, just maybe, I can pass this on to other alcoholics. I believe for me that that afternoon, my primary purpose, my singleness of purpose, if you will, was hatched that afternoon. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And I was ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch or something, you know. And he took me to a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he rolled up to this dingy, stinky, rotten, filthy, perverted Torrance Lamita Alano Club. And I thought, my God, you know. And, you know, who are these people, you know? And there's all these Alanos walking around, you know, and everybody had a nickname and a tattoo, you know. Captain Bob and Indian Genie and Tennessee Bill and Santa Claus Ray and all these people, you know. And Moose came running after me. She had about 102 years, you know. And, hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. And I said, my God, I bet you are, you know. And I'm not it, you know. And this big transvestite started circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk, you know. And he comes walking up to me in his new moo-moo. And, hi, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight dinner, you know. And I said, well, I don't think so, you know. Not till I get my year, you know. And I was out of there. And that was the worst years of my life. From 1975 to 1982, coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That didn't make me a worse alkie or a better member. All it did is prove to me one thing, that I didn't know what was wrong with me. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they were always clean and they were sharp. And every time I called you, this Montana cowboy would come and get me. And he'd take me to a meeting. And about May 2nd, 1982, I'm over there off of Broad in Anaheim in Wilmington. I just got kicked out of a Beacon Light mission. About 5 in the morning, and I start walking the streets, and I'm scared to death because I know I'm going to drink again. I know I am. And I don't want to be the tail on that kite anymore. I'm just like a tail on a kite waiting for that wind to hit, and I'm off and running, and everything in me didn't want to do it again, and I knew I would. And I still had that guy's card in me, and I panhandled some money, and I called this guy. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. He says, why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I thought, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? You know, and I just heard it. And what happened to me is I came to believe that morning And I didn't come to believe in God or the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life with me running the show, and that I knew that at the age of 30 years old, that I'd given this thing the best thing I can do. And I didn't quit drinking. I surrendered. I gave up. I did the hardest thing I've ever had to do, and that was give up the fight. And there seemed to be a big difference in how I looked at this malady that I have. For years, I used to think that I had the malady, that I have this hopeless condition. And I began to realize that I don't have it, it has me. I am in the grips of a progressive illness. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is loosened up that grip just enough to have this experience and carry this message. See, I've been desperate before. On page 155, it says in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, he had a desperate desire to get sober, but he tried many avenues of escape, but he didn't know what it meant to be alcoholic. I didn't know what it meant to be alcoholic. I didn't know that the thing that people had been trying to talk me into doing since I was 13 that was a problem to them was an answer to me. And that I needed a brand new way of life. And when I realized that I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again, but I can get so drunk that I can't make it back, I called up that man and I said, "Don, I'm ready to come back." And I walked that 10 miles. And I did something that I never done before in my life. I asked a man to be my sponsor. And I tell you what, my whole life had changed. I didn't know I took a third step that day. I didn't know that I started having somebody taking suggestions was going to be the key to my life. And at 2 years sober, I would come to you guys in 1984 to my home group. And there I seen what you guys were talking. I had no idea about traditions. I had no idea. I thought they were just things that my sponsor was telling me to do, to get out of here, go put up a chair, you know, or stuff like that, you know. People have always been targets to me. People have always been an avenue of me to get something out of them. And I didn't ask my sponsor to be my sponsor because of any fame or fortune or anything like that he had. But sitting in his house in Downey, in his den, I realized that this convict is living better than I could imagine, and maybe he could get me a job. And he did. He made me a coffee maker. It wasn't what I expected, but it saved my life. And I tell you, for this non-believer, for this guy who has been running from God my entire life, by hanging around you folks and getting introduced to a home group and being introduced to the traditions, our common welfare comes first. My personal recovery depends on you folks. See, I'm new in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is your AA. This is your coffee to make. This is your room to clean. And then what happened to me after about 5 or 6 years became my home group. It became my coffee pot, you know. And now I see that it's our common welfare. It's our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, when a guy's desperate, that's great. It's great to have. There's something that desperation brings. I understand that. But the problem with me is that when I'm desperate, it's like any other emotion that I have. After about 2 months, it wears off. And if my sobriety doesn't have more than desperation, I'm a dead man. I mean, it gets you to do a lot of stuff. But you can only tell a man to do something for so long. But after a while, in taking these steps, that desperation turned into inspiration. What happened to Bill suddenly happened to me gradually. But I couldn't stay sober on inspiration alone either. There had to be perpetuation. I had to do something with this gift. And I tell you, there's a big difference between somebody who has to do something and somebody who's inspired to do something. You see, when somebody's inspired to do something, you don't have to tell them it's meeting night. You don't have to tell them that at 7:45 you should be calling somebody. He knows. He knows. And that this sobriety, this thing that I was feeling, our common welfare comes first, that my personal recovery depends on me. Me doing whatever is necessary for that group to function. It's my great privilege to be to do things in my home group, to do things at the Wednesday night PG meeting, you know? In that chapter, working with others, I think the magic word for me is that word with. You see, when you become somebody in AA at 10 or 11 years sober, you take off on a whole different pattern now. And that's what happened to me after about 6 or 7 years. I become somebody in my own head. I'm a member of this group. I'm this, I'm that. And I rendered myself useless because of a bad attitude. You know? And what happens because of Alcoholics Anonymous, after about 7 years of this nonsense, I made a phone call, the hardest phone call I ever made. And I called my sponsor and I told him what was going on. He says, "Why don't you come back home, jackass?" And I said, "God, I love that man." And I come running home with a surrender that I will never forget. Because now you guys were precious to me. I needed you. You didn't need me. I had to rightly relate to you guys and the group Alcoholics Anonymous like I did my malady. Once I rightly related to this thing that was killing me, this alcoholism, that it had me, it became so necessary for me to do whatever it took to relieve that merciless obsession, you know? And I tell you, in A Vision for You, he talks about it. He talks about the friends and stuff that you're going to meet here and stuff like that. Talks about how necessary it is to carry this message. You know, Bill Wilson, at 6 months sober, stood in a hotel lobby. And he was ready to give it up. The bar was right over there. He could smell the whiskey and hear the music. And everything in him wanted to go over there. And then there was that directory in the phone book. Our life was on the hinges then. And every one of us here is going to have your day in the lobby. Some of them are in it right now. And thank God for your routine. Thank God for your home group. You see, for this non-believer, that's how I came to believe. I came to believe in the very routine that you guys taught me to do. The routine of meetings all week, the phone calls. Consistency breeded faith in this loser. And I began to feel something for this home group that I had that I never felt anything. That something was happening to me when I was with these folks. And that's the neat thing about sponsoring people. See, there's unity there too. There's not just unity in a home group, but there's unity within sponsorship that I absolutely love. And this past year, it hasn't been nothing but for me to be in the most beautiful window that I've ever had in my life with you and my sponsor and my grand sponsor. The most beautiful window that I ever imagined, and how I could almost have lost that. And then I'm excited as heck to see new people come to our meetings and just get a taste of this thing. When they start coming around and they see him getting commitments and stuff like that, and know that that little guy, one of these days, man, you know, that's why it breaks my heart when they take off. You know, I understand. I understand. And that's why when he goes down in those traditions, and they mean so much, they're not just rules. I don't want to hear any more rules, people telling me what to do. Man, it's to keep this thing together, this precious gift. Those very words in that book save people's lives. They don't need me to put new words in that book. That books work fine. They don't need me to do anything but to carry this message and take them to you guys. What a gift we have here. What a gift that we have at this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, where a clown like me can come to believe in this very spirit. And it seemed like these commitments that were punishments came to be the thing that brought it to my attention, that it seemed like the more that I served you, the clearer he became. And that the more I serve me, the darker I become. There's a miracle here. Things happen here to people like me, where just for a moment they can be relieved of the bondage of self. This selfishness, we must get rid of it or it kills us. We must get rid of it or it kills us. How can a little bit of selfishness kill a guy? Come on. You know what I mean? We got to get rid of all of it. I tell you how it can kill this guy. I tell you how it can kill this guy. Where I become so selfish that I don't think I need to lift a finger for my home group. That I become so selfish that I don't think I need to shake somebody's hands that saved my life. That I become so selfish that just because I don't know a new guy, I don't talk to him. That I become so selfish that I have this obsession removed and I don't tell a soul about it. I hope I continually do these things. Our common welfare comes first. The most beautiful word in my life is ours. My personal recovery depends on me doing what you folk needs done. And I thank you for saving my life. I believe that's all I got time for. Thank you so much.